Okay, we have a couple of addendums to the announcements. I think we're not going to be able to do a Bible study next week because John's gone, and there's too much ricocheting to be able to pull that off. However, we do have the announcement about the night to be much observed. Passover's coming up soon. We decided to organize a group meal for the night to be much observed for those who'd like to come at the Sweet Basil, or Basil, if you're in America, in quaint downtown Sugar Creek. Sweet Basil is a private catering facility on Main Street. The food's excellent. While the menu hasn't been finalized, we're confident you'll be delighted. The cost is about $15 per adult. We'll need those who are interested to join us to sign up so we can have an idea about how large the group will be so the plans can get finalized. Sign-up sheets on the information table. Anybody interested to host at home is, of course, welcome to do so. We want everybody to participate in this special celebration with other brethren. So, and that is a key aspect of the night to be much remembered. It's like a Thanksgiving meal, except with a far more biblical basis, you know, as far as the date goes. We are specifically to celebrate the coming out of Egypt spiritually for us. The Israelites celebrated coming out of Egypt physically. So if you'd like to join the larger gathering up at Sugar Creek, then sign the list. If you want to host it at your house or to get together with other brethren close by, please go ahead and make those plans to do so. Okay. Well, I think we're ready to roll here. I have a question to start the sermon off, which serves, frankly, as the title. And I don't know if it's something you're really familiar with yet or not, but you will be after this is over. Here's the question. Would Jesus use a Jesus rifle? Would Jesus use a Jesus rifle? And that will, of course, raise the question, what in the world is a Jesus rifle? Okay. Well, it's been in the news, actually, for the past 2 or 3 weeks. There is a company in Michigan, Wixom, Michigan, actually, called Triacom. I think that's how they pronounce it. It's T-R-I-J-I-C-O-M, or C-O-N, rather, Triacom. And they make gun sights. They make a whole host of gun sights. They make regular-looking scopes, like you'd put a telescopic sight for a rifle. Then they make little shorter ones, which the military likes to use quite a lot. Everything they make is military grade. And then they make some reflex. But the sights are all lighted with radioactive hydrogen, so they're very bright, either with crosshairs or a dot or something like that. It doesn't matter if it's very, very bright sunlight in the desert or it's very, very dark. They still are bright and easy to see, which makes the rifle more deadly if you can see the sights. You get the gist? Now, here's the problem. Triacom founder, his name was Glyn, G-L-Y-N, so I'm thinking Scottish, Glyn Bindon, who is now deceased. His son runs the company. But he started the company 30 years ago, Glyn Bindon did, when he emigrated from South Africa to the U.S. And from the beginning, he would add some letters and numbers to the serial number. He'd have the serial number on the side of the site, and then he would add letters like JN8:12. And you look at that and you think, well, that looks like a lot like John chapter 8 and verse 12. Well, what in the world is John? I hope I'm remembering one of them correctly. John chapter 8 and verse 12. Let's look. I do have one of them memorized in 2 Corinthians. Yeah, one of them is John 8 verse 12. And Jesus spoke to them again saying, I am the light of the world. He who follows me shall not walk in darkness, but have the light of life. So there are a number of scriptural references that speak of Jesus Christ as being the light of the world. Make a reference to that. So at the end of the serial number, they tag those letters and numbers on, and they've done that for 30 years. Nobody noticed. I mean, that nobody noticed it, worried about it. Then some Iraqi and Afghani recruits that were training for their new armies after we conquered the country started asking what that stood for. Somebody told them, and then they got mad. The last thing they were going to do as good Muslims was to shoot a Jesus rifle. Because that's what they started calling them. Rifles with those sights, and they're mounted on their M16 submachine gun rifle. They just referred to them generally as Jesus rifles, and they didn't want to shoot them. So there's a big to-do, and the media, you know, thinks they've really, they scolded Triacom for having religious references on the sides of their gun sights that were going to the military, and so they finally said, okay, we'll take them off. At least we'll take off what we sell to the military. Of course, I don't think they sell much to anybody else. If you want to buy one of the sights, one of the main sights they use, the cheapies, are $1,300. The spendies are $2,500. The gun only costs $1,200. So, you know, if you're going to lose one of them, keep the sight, because it's worth more than the rifle it's actually mounted on. So Triacom is now removing that from future manufactured products, and they're sending 100 packets with the necessary tools to have those scriptural references filed off or whatever that are on the existing sites on the Jesus rifles that are out there in the field at the moment. So that's what a Jesus rifle is, a rifle with a reference to Christ, a scriptural reference that talks about Jesus Christ, included and actually embossed right on the side of the sight that the rifle has. So it actually, you know, it answers some, asks some questions, or some questions come up as to this, in addition to the title question. Why would Glenn Bindon have manufactured Jesus rifles to begin with? What was the idea about putting this scriptural reference on the side of a gun sight? Or it's actually more like a scope. And then we come back to answer the big question of the sermon, what would Jesus use a Jesus rifle? Now, let's look at the human reasoning. It's not necessarily, you know, terrible human reasoning that Mr. Bindon was using 30 years ago when he started this practice. Let's turn to Judges chapter 8 while we talk about it for a minute. Mankind has reasoned his way into doing everything that he's basically done since the Garden of Eden. Bear in mind that in the Garden of Eden, God was offering Adam and Eve the opportunity to start the way of man. And mankind could have gone into having the kingdom of God through the Father and Christ ruling directly, or they could have gone in the direction that they chose to do when they rejected God as their ruler and accepted the ruler or God of this world. He isn't really a God at all. He's a fallen angel. Satan is their ruler. So that's the way it's gone. However, there have been those who recognize that God exists, recognize the Bible is God's word. They don't fully understand it as we understand it. Their minds aren't fully open to all of that. But they reason that they need to stand for something. And I presume, because he died in 2003, that Mr. Bindon had taken this stand for a similar reason to the Lord's sword. You know, you have Jesus rifles, but in the old days you had the Lord's sword. This is the story of Gideon in Judges chapter 8. Now, Gideon was sent out. He was called by God for a specific purpose. And he was sent out to deal with the Midianites and the Amalekites who had allied together and they were overrunning Israel. And then they had been terrorizing Israel for years and years. And when God called Gideon, Gideon was, you remember his calling? He was threshing wheat. Wheat is normally threshed on a mountaintop, on a flat area where the wind will blow the chaff away from the actual grains. But he wasn't there. He was down in what they would use for pressing oil or wine, a wine press or an oil press from olives. In other words, he was down in a hole carved in the rock so he could thresh the wheat out of sight from the Amalekite and the Midianite marauders. You know, Gideon wasn't one that was necessarily itching for a fight. But when finally he got convinced he needed to go and do what he needed to do, then he finally got up and did it. Interestingly, Gideon was a Manassite. So we come down to the story. He has gone up to the camp of the Midianites. And let me find out where I left it. Oh, maybe it was chapter 7. Oh, yes, it was chapter 7. Let me correct that. I look it up in one Bible, and I know where it is on the page. And then I take the other Bible to preach from. That doesn't make very good sense, but that's what I did today. All right, verse 13. Now Gideon has sneaked up on the camp of the Midianites. Remember, he had quite a large army that was recruited from the tribes of Israel. And God smallered it. He made it much smaller, much smaller. Finally, he got down to where he sent all those who were a little bit fearful, sent them home. And then there were still 10,000, which was way too many, so he told them to go down and take a drink of water at the creek, and they did. And he told Gideon, those who stoop down and scoop the water up with their hand, bring it to their mouth, you pick them, send all the others home, who are flattened out on their bellies and just slurping it out of the stream. Mainly, the ones scooping it up with their hand were keeping a watchful eye on what was going around, and the others were kind of oblivious to what was going on. So God wanted those who were watchful to be with Gideon. He only had 300 out of originally having many thousands upon thousands of people with him. He had 300 men. And he armed them with pitchers. Pitchers with lamps on the inside. So there was oil with a wick. And he gave them trumpets. So it was a big band that was going to attack a big lighted band that was going to attack the Midianites. Well, Gideon was a little hesitant, as he had been at the beginning. And so God said, I want you to sneak down to the camp and listen to what's going on. As it happened the same night, the Lord said to him in verse 9, arise and go down against the camp, up to the edge of it, for I have delivered it into your hand. But if you are afraid to go down to the camp with Purah, your servant, and you will hear what they say, and afterward your hand will be strengthened to go down against the camp. So he went down with Purah, and they sneaked up on the outpost of the armed men who were in the camp, and the Midianites and the Amalekites and all the people of the east were lying in the valley as numerous as locusts, and their camels were without number, and as sand on the seashore in multitude. And when Gideon had come, there was a man telling a dream to his companion. When they got within earshot, this one fellow was saying, you know, I just had this weirdest dream. To my surprise, a loaf of barley bread tumbled into the camp of Midian, and it came to a tent and struck it so that it fell and overturned, and the tent collapsed. Now, it's interesting. When Gideon was called to become a judge, he was threshing grain, which would be then made ground and made into bread. So here we have our loaf of barley bread. And then his companion answered him, whoa, this is nothing else but the sword of Gideon, the son of Joash, the man of Israel. For into his hand God has delivered Midian and the whole camp. And so it was when Gideon heard the telling of the dream and its interpretation that he worshipped. You know, he knew what God was doing. He was strengthening his resolve. And he returned to the camp of Israel and he said, arise, for the Lord has delivered us into the camp of Midian into your hand. And he divided the 300 men into three companies, and he put a trumpet in every man's hand and an empty pitchers and torches inside the pitchers. And he said to them, look at me and do likewise. Watch, and when I come to the edge of the camp, you shall do just as I do. When I blow the trumpet and all who are with me, then you shall blow the trumpet on every side of the whole camp and say, the sword of the Lord and of Gideon. And of course, the rest of the chapter talks about that, how that happened. You know, they divided up and they surrounded the camp, and then Gideon came down to his position and he broke his pitcher so that the light would shine, and then he blew on his trumpet, and everybody else broke their pitchers and blew on their trumpets, and when the trumpet stilled, then they all shouted, the sword of the Lord and of Gideon. So you see, we have Jesus' rifles today, but we had the Lord's sword at that time. You know, there was in ancient Israel, because God was using Israel to punish certain nations for various things, he used his sword in the hands of the Israelites, whether it was Gideon or David or whoever. He did that at one time. So I think that Mr. Binden of Triacom, a rifle sight manufacturing company, had a sense of that. You know, he viewed himself, in a, I suppose, as a Christian-type warrior. But that wasn't how God planned for Israel to be. Let's turn back to Deuteronomy chapter 1. Deuteronomy chapter 1. Now, quick overview, Deuteronomy. This is at the end of the 40 years of wandering. Moses had been leading the Israelites the whole time. He's soon going to die because he can't go into the promised land. That's already been decided. So in the last month of his life, he writes the book of Deuteronomy. So he's just right at the end of the 40 years. They're camped right at the Jordan River, waiting to go across and conquer Jericho. But that's going to be the job of Joshua, not Moses. So Moses is giving his final advice, which happens to be inspired, as he puts it down, to the Israelites to strengthen them and encourage them. But part of that is also to scold them. And so we pick up the account in verse 22 of Deuteronomy 1. And every one of you came near to me, and he said, "Let us send men before us and search out the land for us." And about 2 years into the wandering, they had the Exodus, and it was about 2 years later they got over to Kadesh. And from Kadesh they were going to go north into the promised land. 2 years out, not 40 years out from Egypt. And so they said, "Well, let's send some scouts in to spy out the land and see what it's like and see where we need to go." So they did that. Now the two of the scouts, 10 were faithful, or 10 were unfaithful to God, and 2 were faithful. The 2 faithful ones were Joshua, the son of Nun, of the tribe of Ephraim, and Caleb, the son of, for extra credit, what was his dad's name? Jephunneh, of the tribe of Judah. Those were the only 2 of the 12, as you remember the story. So let us send men before us and let them search out the land for us and bring back word of us to us of the way which we should go into the cities which will come. And the plan pleased me well. So I took 12 of your men, 1 man from each tribe, and they departed, and they went up into the mountains, and they came to the valley of Eshcol and spied it out. And they also took some of the fruit of the land in their hands and brought it down to us. And they brought back word for us, saying, "It is a good land which the Lord God is giving us." Nevertheless, in spite of that, you would not go up. But you rebelled against the command of the Lord your God, and you murmured in your tents and said, "Because the Lord hates us, he brought us out of the land of Egypt to deliver us into the hand of the Amorites to destroy us. Where can we go up? Our brethren have discouraged our hearts, saying, 'The people are greater and taller than we.'" See, it probably was kind of they brought back a good report. There were giants in the land, you know, the people like Goliath, you know, although he wasn't alive then, he was later, but there were his ancestors. But the people let themselves get scared. You ever notice how a group think or mob think will change people's minds? People that normally would have half a brain act like it's about a tenth when it gets into mob thinking. You know, and this is the principle. You've heard the old saying, a boy is a boy. When it comes to common sense, a boy is a boy. And 2 boys are half a boy. And 3 boys are no boy at all. They got no sense when you get 3 of them together. And quite often that's the case, unless they have been strictly tutored on having common sense by their parents. Then you're safe. But in your typical run-of-the-mill group, when you get 3, you get a mob, and they're dense. You know, Dave Ramsey is a Christian type financial counselor. He does talk show on the radio, and he has a funny saying he says every so often: "There's no law against stupid. There's no human law against it. There's spiritual laws against it, but no human law." That applied to the Israelites. They said, "And we heard that there were people bigger and taller than us in cities that are great and fortified up to heaven, and moreover, we have seen the sons of Anakim there." You know, even the other scouts started feeding into this mob think, this group think, except for Joshua and Caleb. They stood tall, they told the truth, and they said, "Don't worry about it. God is with us. Giants fall harder just because they're taller." Nobody listened. Then I said to you, do not be terrified or afraid of them. The Lord your God who goes before you, he will fight for you according to all he did for you in Egypt before your eyes. And in the wilderness where you saw how the Lord your God carried you as a man carries his son in all the way that you went until you came to this place. Yet for all that, in spite of what I said, you did not believe the Lord your God. Now, God promised to fight for them, to drive those giants out, drive everybody out, and let them have the land. And Israel didn't want that to happen. They didn't want to go. And then when they did want to go, because if you remember the story, the next day they decided they wanted to go after all. Then they went, you know, on their terms and not God's, and they got thrashed because they ran into the Amalekites, I think it was, that they initially ran into. The bottom line was, Israel chose not to let God fight for them. They wanted to fight their own battles. So when you got to the time of the sword of the Lord in Gideon's day, which was a couple hundred years later, Israel was fighting their own battles, and they did all the way through. They didn't have to do that. God would have done it for them. And this is one of those places that talks about how he would have done that for them. So that's the human reasoning, you see. In a sense, modern Christianity, which believes in, you know, warfare and soldiers fighting, modern Christianity actually follows the Old Testament example of Israel. And there's a reason for that. They don't understand the spirit that Jesus Christ was of. Their eyes aren't opened yet. They don't really know much more than the Israelites did. And in some areas, they know less. The Church of God is different. It has its eyes open, and it is, of course, more responsible for what it knows. So would Jesus use a Jesus rifle? Would he use a rifle that has a reference on the scope that is referring to him? Let's analyze that. Now, we've seen where, I think, Mr. Bindens was coming from. He was a Christian-type warrior in that sense, and therefore he wanted to give credit to God. And, you know, you could admire that up to a point, but will Christian armies, traditional Christian armies, not true Christian armies, but the traditional ones, will they be able to solve the world's problems? Could they bring lasting world peace? If you shake your head, no, you're right. They can't. It's impossible. Take World War II. The Anglo-Saxon powers won the war. Little help from the French, another tribe of Israel. Little help from the Norwegians, another tribe of Israel. Little help from the Dutch, another tribe of Israel. Little help from a couple of Swedes, at least a couple. I don't know if the rest of Sweden helped all that much. But help from the Finns. Finns were stuck. You know, they're fighting the Russians, and then they're stuck with the Swedes on the other side of them. Thus it was for Issachar, and more than likely Switzerland would be Issachar again. Essentially, it was traditional Christianity that won World War II. And you think, well, what about Germany? Weren't they? Well, nominally, there was some kind of a pact with the Roman Church that Hitler had. But Nazism itself, its philosophy was pagan and not really Christian at all. And the pagan and atheistic, as far as God goes. A very strange line of reasoning, but that's okay. Satan manufactures strange kinds of reasoning. And they were locked into it. And so were the militarists of Japan. So it was traditional Christianity, essentially, that won the war, with the exception of Russia. And I know Russia did a lot. But it was America that came out on top. Now, the question was, could traditional Christian warriors bring lasting world peace? And, well, I could ask this. How many wars have we had since World War II? He said, well, we haven't had any other world wars yet. And I said, that's true. But we hadn't had any world wars at all before 1914. We'll have another one. That's coming. It's very clear that it's coming, too. We have had many, many wars, however. Some say the war on terrorism is the beginning of World War III. and in a lot of ways it is, when you look at how wars occur historically. They don't all just suddenly happen between, you know, from first quarter of a particular year. You have a prelude that leads up to the dynamics that actually fire off the big conflagration. But what America and Britain essentially did for the most part with World War II is not going to bring lasting peace. Warfare of man does not solve problems. It may solve one problem or two for a while, but it's only for a while, and then there'll be another war. That's just the way man is. So, that's human reasoning, and that's as good as it gets. Somebody who, you know, wants to be a Christian-type warrior, kind of like Gideon was for Israel, except that Gideon was a judge that God specifically used to do something that he wanted done. And traditional Christianity is not in that particular category as Gideon was. Now let's look at the divine reasoning, God's reasoning. Let's go to Luke chapter 9. Luke chapter 9. Would Jesus use a Jesus rifle? All right. Chapter 9, and let's see, this section is toward the end, starts about verse 51. Down to 56. James and John are featured in this, in verse 54. They were the brothers, the sons of Zebedee. And Jesus had a nickname that he gave them. He gave Peter a name. He called Peter, Peter. His name was Simon, remember? And James and John, he gave a nickname to the brothers. He called them Boanerges. In Greek, that means the sons of thunder. This is one of the reasons why. And it's interesting. James was the first martyr of the 12 apostles, first one to die, not very long into the years of the church. And John was the last one to die. And he became known as the apostle of love, based on the theme of his writings. So there was, you know, they had a great destiny. Some speculate that, and I think with reason, that they may have been, through Mary's relatives, cousins of Jesus. James and John may have been. Very, very possibly. So he called them the sons of thunder. And this is the case where they're going to Jerusalem and they're going through a Samaritan village, and the Samaritans were not Jews. They were Gentiles. Oh, they had a little bit of Israelite blood with them because they had been brought from Babylon by the Assyrians 700 years earlier when they took the 10 tribes captive. They brought some Samaritans and they put them in Samaria. They didn't cover the whole area where the 10 tribes had been, but around the capital city of Samaria. But they were from Babylon. And then that they had been probably troublemakers over there, and so that was the way the Assyrians did it. If you caused too much trouble, they just deported all of you, lock, stock, and barrel, and dump you somewhere else to sort of uproot you from your homeland, hoping that that will weaken your revolting behavior. It didn't always work. The Israelites continued to revolt. The Samaritans didn't, however. They were fairly pacifistic as far as the Assyrians went. However, they had a terrible time. If you remember the story, it's back in 1 Kings chapter, 2 Kings chapter 17. They had man-eating lions that started marauding around Samaria. Now, if you've ever studied man-eating lions, which I have, it's kind of an interesting sidelight to read about now and then. Not very much, just a little bit. Tigers and leopards, they're also interesting to read about. But man-eating lions have a habit that they develop. They kind of decide they like human flesh. And if there's a lot of dead people laying around and they start eating it, they decide it's not so bad. So then they'll go and get live people and make them dead and then eat them. And that's how man-eaters operate. And, of course, that's scary. I mean, that's back in the days before LED flashlights, you know, like the little bitty flashlight I've got in my briefcase that is like the big one I used to have. with regular light. You didn't have any flashlights and any lion rifles or Jesus rifles. It didn't matter. To shoot the lions, you know, they're terrifying to have a man-eating feline preying upon your village, where they can break through your door, which man-eating lions have been known to do in Africa, and tigers in India, and leopards for that matter. Leopards are little scrawny ones compared to the lions. Lions, the most famous man-eating lions are the man-eaters of Tsavo in Uganda. When the Uganda-Mombasa Railway was being built in the late 1800s, and they, between the two of them, they figure they must have eaten several hundred people, maybe 500 people. And those, they finally killed him. It was the officer, the British officer, who was actually an Irish-British officer, finally killed both of them. He was the engineer in charge of a particular bridge at the Tsavo River. He killed both those lions, and they weighed between 500 and 550 pounds each. Gigantic cats. That's really huge trophy class for African lions. So they had these lions that were eating the Samaritans, and the Samaritans, you know, that freaked them out, so they got a hold of their Assyrian governor, and he said, send us some of the priests from this land, because we don't know who the god of this land is. They were pagans, and every land had a god in their mind, and we need to pacify him so he'll call off his cats. So they sent in some Levites, and God called off the cats, for whatever reason he wanted to do. But the Levites then taught them a little bit of the truth, which they mixed with their Babylon mystery religion, and that later got exported to Italy around the time the church was beginning. So you had the Samaritans. There was still a population of them there, and they because they had married in a little bit into the Levitical tribe, they decided they were the true Israelites, and the Jews in Jerusalem were imposters. And you shouldn't worship in Jerusalem. You should worship on Mount Gerizim, which was outside of Samaria. So you see, that seems ludicrous when it was. But that's what they thought. And so the Jews and the Samaritans just didn't get along. So they're coming through a village of Samaria, and the Samaritans won't leave the light on at the Motel 6. And they won't rent lodgings when they realize these Jews are going to Jerusalem. So, you know, we're not going to support that. And so James and John then wanted to have them done in. They wanted to call fire down from heaven. So here's how it all played out. You can read along there, but this is a paraphrase. The sons of thunder stood shoulder to shoulder, locked and loaded, ready to unleash their apostolic weapon of mass destruction. Their honor had been impugned. How dare this village of peasants refuse to rent them lodging for the night? In their minds, these people were toast, literally. They stood ready to call fire down from heaven like a vast flamethrower and fry the scum, men, women, and children. With fire in their eyes and flame in their bellies, they addressed their commander. Sir, permission to fire this town. They winced at his response. Boys, chill. You don't even know what manner of spirit you're of. For the Son of Man didn't come to destroy men's lives, but to save them. Sir, yes, sir, then we'll go on to another village, okay? Thank you, gentlemen. That's another paraphrase of it. That's about what happened. They wanted to call fire down from heaven, on like Elijah did, on the village of Samaria. And in verse 55, he turned and rebuked them, and he said, this is where he said, chill out. You do not know the manner of spirit you are of, for the Son of Man did not come to destroy men's lives, but to save them. And they went to another village. So Christ specifically intervened on behalf of this village. It didn't bother him that they didn't want him to stay there. James and John had a lesson they needed to learn. This wasn't God's way. You're not going to go killing people. I didn't come here to kill people. I came here to save people. Now, that's the spirit we're of. Not here to kill people. We're here to save people. We follow Jesus Christ. He is our Savior and our Messiah. This is a great lesson of understanding what manner of spirit we're of, and realizing that if we're not careful, we fall into the James and John mentality, the sons of thunder mentality as far as violence and self-defense in a crazy world. We have a steady diet of violence. You can see it on the news. And then you have films and television shows that have way, way more violence graphically portrayed than is necessary to convey the storyline of the plot. They don't need to do that. They do that because it kicks the adrenaline in. And this kind of gratuitous, gory violence that pervades so many of movies and television shows and video games, particularly video games, they feed on the violence. All that is, that is to a spirit of peacefulness what pornography is to adultery. You know, pornography is a type of adultery, and that's, essentially violent porn or violence porn. We need to be careful about what we watch, what we consider to be entertaining, what books we even want to read. And when you find that, oh, hold it, all they're doing is doing this to, make people angry or make them feed vicariously, it's feeding into that mob think that we talked about at the beginning, the three boys thinking. We need to deeply understand what manner of spirit we are of. I think we can see that the answer is going to be, and it already is, that Jesus would not use a Jesus rifle. He didn't come here to kill people. He came here to save people. We're called to do what he did. Now let's look at the core teaching. There's a lot that we could cover. We're just going to cover some of the key things here today. Matthew chapter 5. This is from the Sermon on the Mount. The Sermon on the Mount was really a watershed message. It wasn't really, it was more of a teaching on the Mount, called a sermon simply because the core teaching has been assembled in what sounds like a sermon, but it would have taken place over a number of hours up on top of this mountain. Initially, it was just to his disciples. Gradually, the multitude got up to the top of the mountain and were listening to him, too. He talks about murder. The sixth commandment is, you shall not kill or you shall not murder. He said in verse 21, Christ's words, you have heard that it was said of those of old, you shall not murder, and whoever murders will be in danger of judgment. But I say to you that whoever is angry with his brother without a cause will be in danger of the judgment. And whoever says to his brother, Raca, empty head, will be in danger of the council. And whoever says, you fool, will be in danger of hellfire. That doesn't mean that the word fool, as we use it in English, it carries the meaning of the term here. This is a term where you denounce somebody as being completely worthless. And it's an attitude of hatefulness and despising that is being used to verbally attack somebody. Well, that's a spirit of hatred. And he says you can be in danger of hellfire for just hating somebody. Therefore, if you bring your gift to the altar, and there remember that your brother has something against you, leave your gift there at the altar and go your way and find first be reconciled to your brother and then come and offer your gift. Get this hatred out of your heart. Now, it's similar to the core teaching about adultery. We drop down to verse 27. You have heard it was said of old, you shall not commit adultery. But I say to you that whoever looks at a woman to lust after her has already committed adultery with her in his heart. And you stop and think about that. Okay, the committing of adultery is typically thought of as sexual relations outside the bounds of marriage. And Jesus said, oh no, it's thinking about that, lusting after somebody else. All right, if the action, the sex act itself is adultery, and the thought of it, the lust is the thought of it, is adultery, then anything in between is also adultery. So those empty, those silly thinkers that periodically pop up, they say, well, it isn't adultery unless you're married. They need to go to a warm room and let their head warm up, because it's a little numb. They're not thinking. Very clearly, this is the principle of the spirit of the law, whether it applies to the seventh commandment or the sixth commandment. You go on down. In verse 43, you have heard it said that you shall love your neighbor and hate your enemy. But I say to you, love your enemies. Whoa, just a minute. Bless those who curse you. Do good to those who hate you. Now, how diametrically opposed is that to the way of human nature and the way of mankind in general? People don't love their enemies, they hate their enemies. As I said, modern Christianity, the modern world simply follows the same thing the Israelites did in ancient Israel. They hate their enemies. Well, for that matter, all the other nations hated each other too. It wasn't just Israel. It was all of them. Human nature is as it was and as it will be until it's changed to a divine nature. And that's what's happening in our minds. Our human nature is being changed into the divine nature. We're overcoming the human and replacing it with the divine nature from God's Spirit. That's the spirit we're of. It's a different spirit, a different attitude with different actions in the church. Do good to those who hate you and pray for those who spitefully use you and persecute you, that you may be sons of your Father in heaven. As He makes His sun to rise on the evil and on the good, He sends rain on the just and the unjust. Love your neighbor as yourself. Don't hate him. Now, how does that transpose? You see, Christ, that's Christ's teaching. That's His teaching. That's the core of what He was all about, and that's the instructions, commandments that He gave to us. The church is under the new covenants of applying that spirit of the law. We obey the law and beyond the law, in the sense of beyond the letter of the law. Israel didn't understand anything beyond the letter of the law, let alone try to obey it as a nation. Let's go back to 1 Peter chapter 2. Do you remember a time when Peter was more like James and John? Where he did something that was the same as what they wanted to do, except he took the action. He just was a little awkward. The guy's name was Malchus. At the start of the evening, he had two ears. And halfway through the evening, he had one. And when Peter swung the sword, when they were coming to arrest Jesus, you know, he said he wanted two swords to be taken so that they could claim that they were, you know, robbers. And Peter decided he was going to use the sword in not self-defense, but when you're defending one who you love, who is your friend, then that's just extended self-defense, isn't it? Like somebody defending his family, or it's like an army defending their nation. It's all the same. You know, using force and violence to do that. And so Peter took the sword and he took a whack at the first person probably that came close to him, which happened to be the servant of the high priest, whose name was Malchus. And I don't think he was aiming for the ear. Because how many people do you know except Zorro that goes around and could flick off somebody's ear with a sword? And Peter was a fisherman. And, you know, this was not a rapier, which the sword fighting, the fencing is done with. This was a heavy sword. And he took a whack. He probably wanted to try to split his head in two is what he was trying to do. But he missed and got the ear. And Jesus corrected Peter. Sharply, put your sword away. And he picked the ear up and he stuck it back on a guy's head. You know, when you're Christ, you can do that. In the right place, didn't have to stitch it. It was healed just like that. It had to be amazing. It had to give Malchus some food for thought. And I can't wait till the first resurrection to find out if he happens to be in it. You know, you stop and think about the effect of some of these events that weighed on people's minds after a while. So Peter now had to learn that lesson the hard way and to be publicly corrected by Christ, which he was more than once. But, you know, he learned from that. When we pick up this account in verse 20 and we think about it, you know, how our tendency humanly is to defend. You know, if somebody gets mad at us, then we're going to fight with them, whether it's verbally or maybe physically or what have you. We don't get mad, we get even, which means you get mad. For what credit is it, in verse 20, if you are beaten for your faults and you take it patiently? Now, we all have our faults, and if we get punished for our faults, well, just take it on the chin because we deserve it. But if you do good and you suffer for that and you take it patiently, this is commendable before God. This is the spirit you're of. For to this end you were called, because Christ also suffered for us, leaving us an example that you should follow in his step. He committed no sin, nor was guile found in his mouth, who, when he was reviled, did not revile in return. He didn't even use verbal self-defense. When he suffered, he did not threaten, but committed himself to him who judges righteously. You see, Christ knew that if need be, he had legions of angels that would step in to protect him. But when it was time for him to offer himself as a sacrifice, he didn't try to defend himself then, even though he knew that the angels weren't allowed then to step in. The time had come. Who himself bore our sins on his own body, in his own body on the tree, that we, having died to sins, might live for righteousness, by whose stripes you were healed. So you see, Christ didn't strike back. When he said, love your enemy, he showed that love for his enemies. And he had plenty of enemies. So there's a lesson for us. That's our goal, to be like he is. Now, let's go back to Matthew again. Well, there's another event that brings out a prophecy of Christ as Messiah. And it's a very intriguing prophecy indeed. Matthew 12, he caused a stir. This, the first part of the chapter is all about keeping the Sabbath and stating in verse 8, for example, the Son of Man is Lord even of the Sabbath. In other words, he is the commander. Bear in mind, we don't worship the Sabbath. We don't worship the law of God. We worship the one who gave us the Sabbath and gave us the law. That is God, the Father and Christ, the family of God. And the Son of Man, Christ himself, is the Lord or the master even of the Sabbath. Now, when he departed from there, he went into their synagogue, and there was a man who had a withered hand. And they asked him, saying, is it lawful to heal on the Sabbath? They were testing Christ as a rabbi, because he was obviously a teacher and recognized as such by many in the public. And so the leaders, which probably were some of the Pharisees, were challenging him, that they might accuse him. And he said to them, what man is there among you who has one sheep? And if it falls into the pit on the Sabbath, will not lay hold of it and lift it out? How many of you would leave your sheep in a pit where it might die? And you think, well, if it's not too bad of a pit, it'd probably be okay. All right, I'll give you a scenario. It was as it occurred on a Sabbath when I was a teenager. I went down to feed the cattle. We'd had some lousy, cold March weather. It was down in the 20s or so, or actually in the teens, I think. And the cows were calving, and so we had to check them regularly. And I came around the bend, and I could see across the ravine there was a cow on her back with her feet in the air. She wasn't dead. So I hurried around there. The calf was trying to be born. And she had laid down on a slope, and then as she was straining to give birth to the calf, she rolled. She laid down with her feet uphill. Dumb move. And she was only probably just a foot or so from the edge of a drop-off. Wasn't a far drop-off, but it was about 2.5 feet into a trail where they came up out of a swampy ravine up to the field, and she landed in the mud in that trail, and she was stuck on her back and couldn't turn over. And, we knew that a cow that lays like that isn't going to live very long, especially in cold, bad weather. So I turned the truck around, ran and got Dad, and told him what had happened. We grabbed a tractor because we couldn't get even the pickup over to where she was. And we had to get her out of there. And this is a Sabbath morning. But it's something that had to be done. You couldn't leave her there. So we put a chain. The only way we could get her up into the grassy area of the slope, where it was a little bit less slopy, was to put a chain around her neck and drag her up there. Now, cattle can handle that. If she'd have had horns, we'd have put her around the horns and pulled her up there, but she didn't. She just had to put it on and drag her about 20 or 30 yards and then, you know, ease off so she, get the chain off so she could breathe again. She survived that all right. The calf was dead. We pulled the calf because she'd been struggling to give birth probably for a couple of hours, and she would have been dead within another hour, I think. And then she had hypothermia. You can tell she was shaking. We got her turned over onto her belly and her feet under her a little bit, but not completely. Her joints had gotten stiff. She was always crazy after this, and I don't know what was the craziness was brought on by. We built a fire around her. I think this didn't help. We went and got some bales of hay, and we broke them apart, and we built a ring of fire around her, just, you know, and torched it so that she could warm up. And that was the only way we could get her warm. We didn't have anything effective to pick her up and haul her up and put her in the house like we did with calves. So you had to build a fire. And it was a combination, I think, of being on her back, losing her calf, and then being surrounded by a ring of fire that kind of addled her brain. You know, and she ended up with her eyes would bug out. We referred to her as the bug-eyed mean cow, because she was just a little nuts after that. Now let me explain. We tended to look after animals like that, so we brought her up later to the corrals and kept her near the house for several years. And you had to always be careful when you went into the pen she was in, which is where we kept the cows we milked. It added a little excitement for us boys when we were milking the cow. You kept your eye on where that cow was because you never knew when she'd just get a little nutty and try to chase you out of the pen. But we, Sabbath or not, she had to have her life saved. She had to be pulled up out of it. And that was her pit. Likewise, a sheep on its back is going to die quicker than a cow. So you got to get them out of the pit. You can't get them down stuck into the mud. They just don't last very long when they're in that kind of a situation. So the question he asked is a no-brainer. Yes, obviously, you will grab that animal, even if it's on the Sabbath, and you'll do what it takes to pull it out. And so he said to the man, stretch out your hand. The man had a withered hand, remember? And it was restored as whole as the other. And the Pharisees went out and took counsel against him, how they might destroy him. So you see, the Pharisees just couldn't see the point of the Spirit of God's law and couldn't understand the Spirit, the Holy Spirit, of which Christ was of, you know, the way God thinks. They couldn't fathom it. They just got angry at it, even though his logic was pristine. But when Jesus knew that, then he withdrew from there. Notice he didn't stay and wait for them to try to attack him. He just left. And great multitude followed him, and he healed them all, and he warned them not to make him known, that it might be fulfilled which was spoken by Isaiah the prophet. And now we come to the prophecy of the Spirit that Christ was of. Behold, my servant whom I have chosen, and by the way, this is from Isaiah 42, right at the beginning. My servant whom I have chosen, my beloved in whom my soul is well pleased, I will put my Spirit upon him. Now, this is the Spirit of which Christ was of. It was, you know, God's Spirit. He will declare justice to the Gentiles. Now, we're talking world peace, class, justice, and the millennium that will happen. In verse 19, he will not quarrel nor cry out. He will not quarrel nor cry out. Quarrels start small and escalate, and big quarrels are called wars. Right? He doesn't come to make war like human beings. Nor will anyone hear his voice in the streets. Verse 20, a bruised reed he will not break, and smoking flax he will not quench, till he brings forth justice to victory, and in his name the Gentiles will trust. The bruised reed he will not break. There is a gentleness of God's Spirit and of the Spirit we're of that doesn't break the bruised reed. It deals gently with mankind. It is not our place to take life, not our place to take life in the spirit, that is, through hatred or through violent action. If Jesus would not use a Jesus rifle, neither would his followers. There's the conclusion we're heading for. Let's go to Romans now in chapter 13. Actually, I want to cover a point in chapter 12, which summarizes the spirit that we're of and answers this question, the addendum for us, should we use Jesus' rifles? Verse 17, repay no one evil for evil. And some say, well, but what about in a just war? If one nation attacks another one because they were attacked first, isn't that just? Isn't that good? That's a good war. You can't evaluate man's wars by the spirit of God's law. What war of mankind has ever been just? Aside from specific actions that God had used Israel to exact as punishment on certain nations, man's wars have only brought more wars later. Once they recover, then they have another war. They don't know the way to peace. Repay no one evil for evil. Have regard for good things in the sight of all men. If it is possible, as much as depends on you, live peaceably with all men. What if it's not within you? Then don't live with them. Live a little ways away. You know, that's the implication there. Beloved, and verse 19 really gets to the crux of it, do not avenge yourselves, whether that's mentally, verbally, or using force or violence. Do not avenge yourselves, but rather give place to wrath, as it is written, vengeance is mine, I will repay. In other words, that's God's department. Don't take over God's department. When Christ was on earth as the Son of Man, he did not take vengeance. That was God's department. Now, when he comes the second time, he actually does come to exact vengeance where it should be exacted on mankind, teach some lessons, and start things over again. Therefore, if your enemy hungers, feed him. If he thirsts, give him a drink. This is loving your enemies. For in so doing, you're going to heap coals of fire upon his head. Do not be overcome by evil. And ultimately and fundamentally, the world is evil. Now, that is not to be derogatory toward mankind. It's just simply the way of man is evil. It does not lead to eternal life. It does not lead to the justice of sins forgiven. It just leads to more sins and more war and more misery. So don't be overcome by evil. Rather, we, because we are attached to the Father and to Christ through the connection of the Holy Spirit, we are to overcome evil with good. Some of that overcoming we'll have to wait until we're resurrected, and some of it we can do now. Now we drop down into chapter 13. As far as whether we should use Jesus' rifles, Jesus doesn't use them, should we use them? Verse 8, owe no one anything except to love one another, for he who loves has fulfilled the law. It is our duty to love our fellow humans. For the commandments, you shall not commit adultery, you shall not murder, you shall not steal, you shall not bear false witness, you shall not covet, and if there's any other commandment, are all summed up in this saying, namely, you shall love your neighbor as yourself. Love does, and verse 10 is critically important, love does no harm to a neighbor. Therefore, love is the fulfillment of the law. Love does no harm to a neighbor. Aggressive, lethal force, or potentially lethal force, does harm. Christ did not use that kind of force. Christ does not use Jesus' rifles, even if it's got his name referred to on it. we are to love mankind, we are to be like that as well. Now, the final piece of this puzzle of answering the question and layering on the proof to where it's rock solid is found toward the end of the book of John. It's in chapter 18. This is our ultimate orientation. We are not like our fellow human beings in the world because we've been called out of the world, and you have to take that statement seriously. It doesn't make us better than others. It actually is, a burden that we bear. It's a good burden, by the way, because they bear worse burdens. We would bear worse burdens if we were running around breaking God's laws all the time. But it is our burden to bear. We need to realize that our focus is not just on solving our problems now, or trying to see the world solve its problems now. We try to do what we can humanitarian-wise, the cattle project for Kenya, although that will directly help some of the brethren over there. It'll also help their neighbors. Does that solve the problems of Kenya? Will that solve the problems in that province of Kenya? No, it'll help that village a little bit. It's just a little bit that we can do. We try to do what we can do. But we would like to solve all the world's problems. We would like to bring the solution and the resolution of every problem and sin and terrible thing in the world to an end. And thus we will. Jesus told Pontius Pilate, he said, "My kingdom," in verse 36 of John 18, should memorize this, "My kingdom is not of this world." Now, Christ's kingdom is the kingdom of God. And what do you know? That's our kingdom too. As Americans, we don't have a kingdom. We have a republic, if we can keep her. As Benjamin Franklin said when the Constitutional Convention ended, everybody called him doctor for whatever reason. And the Constitutional Convention was the entire summer of 1787. And so it was concluding, they finished everything, and the people in Philadelphia wanted to know what the results were. And as they were coming out of the final meeting of the entire thing, they had the Constitution in hand. One of the ladies in the town said, "Well, doctor, do we have a monarchy or do we have a republic?" Because there were some who wanted to make George Washington king, And George Washington said, "Nobody's going to make me king. I'm not that George." For the third time, "I'm not that George." So they tried several times to do it. And he believed in the way that America ended up being. Manasseh does not have the nature for a kingdom. We have the nature for a republic. She said, "Well, doctor, do we have a republic or do we have a monarchy?" And he said, "Madam, we have a republic if we can keep her." Now, the "if we can keep her" part seems very apropos to our current crisis in America, and it probably has at various times in America's history. But our kingdom, we have a kingdom as the Church of God. It's not of this world. "If my kingdom were of this world," Jesus said, "my servants would fight. But since it's not of this world, we're his servants, we don't fight. Not here, not now. So that I should not be delivered to the Jews. But now my kingdom is not from here. It's from there, where the Father is. And it is coming here soon." Jesus' rifles will not solve the world's problems. In fact, if you take the references to the scriptures of Jesus as the light of the world, which indeed he is, off of those gun sights, on those rifles, they still won't solve the problems of the world. But Jesus Christ will.